Today, we are going to, you know, if anybody has anything that they would like to say about any upcoming data release. And, you know, I mean, I think that people have spent enough time thinking about this that, I mean, really, we don't even need to come to the webcast this afternoon, right? Because it's all been worked out. Of the people who told me that they are going to say things, and anybody else is, of course, welcome to say things, but of the people who responded yesterday, this is what we're going to have. We're going to start with Team Elastic, who's going to tell us about some Elastic things. Liam is then going to follow up, where's Liam, on Elastic bits as well. I'm going to then take one for the Team Inelastic. Doug, if his code is finished working by then, he'll then tell us about parameter fits. Nima, who is still here, if his code is finished working, will tell us about an operator analysis. Then we'll move into models. Right now, the only model that somebody is, specific model somebody wants to talk about is Wienos, but then we'll have some connection with SuperSimulSync, so Gordy will tell us about Wienos. And then it's a free-for-all. So, if something's missing here from what you would like to hear about, then, you know, start frantically writing notes or typing on your laptop, and then you'll have an opportunity to talk. So let's start with Team Elastic.
I brought my dongle.
Oh, you
I guess I could. Yeah, I can use yours. I mean, it doesn't matter. Oops, sorry. Don't trip. Oh, yeah. That's exactly what I wanted. Oh, wrong way. I'll switch this. We'll switch the
Just hit X when you open it.
X? Yeah. Is that true? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yes, I have. I have a great expression. You
Special session.
Okay. Where's my cursor? It's probably over there. Sorry.
What are you looking for?
I'm just trying to find my cursor. Is it on?
Yeah, it's here. Okay.
So now I found it. Okay. Very good. Okay.
All right. Okay, so we're Team Elastic, and here's our spokesman, Mr. Fantastic. This is stuff that's come up with discussions with Itai and many others. And I think Mr. Fantastic is a very good, well, so first of all, we're obviously very interested in figuring out, or kind of maybe some people have put money on how much events future experiments might see. And Mr. Fantastic, even though he's super intelligent, as you can read from his Wikipedia page, he possesses a mastery of all levels of physics. I don't know what that means. And according to Business Week, who apparently does this kind of stuff, he's listed as one of the top 10 most intelligent fictional characters in American comics. And I think he also may even have indirectly discovered dark matter because he invented a spacecraft and was bombarded by cosmic radiation. So he's really equally, he's one of the most, well, for fictional characters, one of the best, I guess, most qualified people to predict how much a future experiment might see. And even he's hedging his bets. He's got 0 and 4. And 0 and 4, I think, are kind of, you know, probably a couple of us have already thought about this. 0 is kind of like, oh, you know, there's nothing. In terms of a beyond the standard model, physicists is not interesting. And 4 is where it's like, it really is starting to get interesting. So let me set some of the ground rules we decided to do in playing this game, which I like to call the Poisson Olympics. And as Patty reminded me, this really means it's a fishing expedition. We're all hoping to have this scenario, maybe in this comic, but we don't know. And I would just want to give some context in terms of a certain set of possibilities for elastic scattering. What should we expect? And so just look at spin-independent and spin-dependent couplings. In particular, spin-dependent, I assume that the proton and neutron couplings are the same. It's not a big change if you relax that. And our rule to when we were playing was to just say, well, if we want a consistent picture once the new data is released, and so we're allowing ourselves basically one kind of accident. In terms of limits, we're just allowing ourselves to saturate the best 90% confidence level limit, and then predict forward what CDMS might see. Okay, so to do this, let me just remind you of what's out there. For spin independent, we'll start at that. This is in terms of cross section per nucleon for the WIMP, and this is the mass. And you can see that basically in three different mass regions, there's three different mass regions to consider if you want to consider what the best limit is. So at the high mass range, there's the CDMS germanium limits, which set the best limits. Somewhere below about 50 GeV, there's the xenon 10 limits. And then at very low mass, at about 10 GeV or so, the CDMS silicon limits start to be the best. We wanted to, also this is taken from a talk by Filippini, and we wanted to see, well, there's been some stuff presented in this workshop which makes us realize that this xenon 10 curve may need some updating or reevaluation. In particular, there was a talk by Peter which was doing this reanalysis of xenon 10 to try to clean up the any events that might be due to background and the nuclear acceptance band. And as, if you remember from that plot, there was no events up to quite a large recoil energy. And so even though this is not a blind analysis, we feel like it's useful to use this as a guide for what are the limits. So we're going to try to do our best in reevaluating this for what it entails for the elastic. Okay? And we're going to try to be conservative, so we're going to actually use, so this was for this L effective parameter was taken to be constant in 0.19, and there's been the recent measurements that Dan showed yesterday, which say that L effective should be smaller, which means this threshold is really higher than it seems here. And that means that lower mass dark matter should not be as strongly constrained by if you take that. So we're going to use this new data and use the new data for the L effective and do our best job of doing the limit. So here is our version, and there are three curves that you should remember from the previous plot. There's CDMS in red, the old xenon 10 in black, and the gray is the CDMS silicon. Okay. So here in the dashed orange is the xenon 10 reanalysis that we've tried to do. We took a threshold of 3 keV, which is not quite as low as the where the last bin goes. It goes down to actually to 2 keV. And that was from talking to Peter, and there's different thresholds, actually not well, there's the S2 threshold that's shown here, but there's also an S1 threshold, and 3 keV was kind of what he guessed would be a pretty safe estimate.
So 3 keV are assuming this
0.19, that's right. And then we used your measured values to do this, and this is what we find. So that we find that there's a little bit of a weakening maybe at the low mass, but not much, and the trough kind of moves to higher mass because the kind of the event, the first event that appears is now much further out than in the old xenon 10 data. Okay? So, If we use the lower threshold, go down to 2, and you could lower that, then of course this will move back down. And if you maybe if you make the L effective kind of vary it within the uncertainties, you can make this move forward. So there's kind of some uncertainties here, but this is taking central values and these assumptions. Okay, so our game is to take this. In terms of the limits, again, it's at high mass, it's CMS germanium, and at low mass, it's this xenon 10 reanalysis. Our game is just to say, well, for a given mass, take the largest cross-section allowed by the best limit. And let's predict what a CMS will see. Okay. And this is what we see. This is the kind of, so saturating limit, this is the expected number of events as a function of mass. And red is the new CMS. And green is Edelweiss. So Edelweiss was the other plot on there that I didn't show. The reason why we put Edelweiss here is Edelweiss has a similar technology as CMS. The only difference is that their threshold is not as low. It's between it's from 20 kV up to 100 is their acceptance region, whereas CMS is from 10 to 100. So CMS can kind of see the lower energy recoils, but Edelweiss is kind of probing a similar part of the recoil space of signals. And so what we've done here is Edelweiss is here shown, the number of expected events when you saturate this. And let me remind you that Edelweiss actually saw one event in this. So this is consistent. This plateau of one is consistent. And the same kind of high mass region, CMS was the strongest limit, so that's why there's a constant number of events at CMS, and it's about 3. What's kind of interesting is if you break it up between the number of events you expect between 10 to 20, which is the region that Edelweiss is not covering, you expect about 1. Okay? And this was assuming that the exposure is just going up. There's no increase in efficiencies. So it's about 1.7 times the exposure of the previous five-tower run.
Do we know why Edelweiss can't go to lower?
I think it's just resolution. Their threshold just has to be set higher. But that's as far as in the paper, that's what they say. Okay, so in terms of the interesting numbers, of course we're hoping that CMS sees lots of a handful of events. So really, in terms of spin independent elastic, really you want to be at masses maybe greater than about 50. And this kind of should, I guess, be taken if you haven't made a bet with Mike, and I don't know if the deadline is passed. But this is a Poisson expectations kind of at the high end for the amount of events you expect at CMS. Okay, so you expect roughly somewhere between 2 and 3, and otherwise you expect somewhere around 1. And what's interesting is, again, this once you're in the high mass range, you really are saying that there should be about twice as many events in the high 20 to 100 region as compared to the 10 to 20 region for CMS. Okay? You can see this by looking at the spectra. Here's a CMS spectra. 50 is the more steeply falling curve, and 250 is the more shallower curve, okay? And these are using the normalization. So this is in per kV. So this would, if you integrate these, it would get 3 events, roughly. And xenon, it would look like this instead. So 50 again is the more steeply falling, and then 250 is the more shallow. So the prediction for xenon 100 for this kind of the regions here is that, well, you could get about order 10 events. I think from Elena's talk, I estimated maybe 16 events. And so you really would start to get some kind of rough mass determination from this.
Can you say again, what is the cross section that you're using?
I'm just saturating the limit here. So
Okay. Essentially
I'm saying the cross section is this as a function of mass up to this point, and then now it's this.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. And that, this behavior of this deviating from CMS is just telling you why the number of events are so much lower at CMS at low mass, right? Okay. All right. Why are they wiggly? Those are the acceptances in the different boxes. So it's because of the acceptance changes, in each box. So it's
use the xenon 10.
Yeah, use the what Peter the xenon 10 reanalysis those efficiency. Yeah, And I think that's for, I think this is for the L effective equals 0.19, so it's not scaled to the other one. But, you know, so that's, that you can compare this to the plot that the Xeon 10. You know. Okay, so that's all I was going to say about spin independent. Anything we want to discuss? So there's a equal, there's a similar story you can say for spin dependent. I'll just look at the cases where you just have either neutron or proton couplings. Let me just remind you of the limits here. Proton couplings will not be interesting at CMS under our guidelines of allowing one accident. Because as you can see, CMS, their limit is right about here, and there's several experiments which are really strongly constraining anything near that. So by the time you kind of saturate this limit, you'll expect very few events. There's a better story for neutrons because neutron couplings because you know, xenon 10 and CMS are here. So xenon 10 and zeppelin 3 are the limits here. So it's not, you know, it's harder to get kind of the three or four events at CDS in this case because it's never the best limit in any region of the parameter space. So you have to saturate some other experiment's limit, which is separated from CDS. Okay, but we can still play that game and see what happens. Here the expected number of events. So CMS expects maybe around 2 or 1.8 or so high mass. And again, there's maybe here it's a little bit, it's not as big of a hierarchy, but maybe it's like they're equal numbers between 10 to 20 and 20 and higher. Edelweiss probably expects around 0.7 or so. So again, though, there's since xenon 10 is much better limit than CMS at low mass, again, you see that if you want to see anything interesting, you have to be above 50 or so. Okay, I can show you the spectra also for this case. CMS will look like this. It's with the spin-dependent form factors, it's not as big of an effect as you go to higher mass. As you can especially see in xenon, the form factors really are very hard to distinguish between 50 and 250. So there won't be, even though xenon 100 would get a lot of events, it's much harder to do the mass discrimination, at least at face value. Okay. Okay, so that's basically all I had to say. And I think the question it's actually funny to use the Simpsons characters because they only have four fingers. Right? I don't know how to count Spock here. And I think Kirk is just... So that's basically all I had to say. So... Okay.
Questions, objections, your own analysis or thoughts that you want to add in. By the way, Spencer, you can go for me. Or, Grant, you can go for me. No? Everybody is now 20.
I guess I could say one thing is just that for the spin independent case, we didn't go below 10, but you can see from these kind of plots that at that point, there's a better limit from CMS silicon. And so this kind of separation says that essentially, if you're going to get a large amount of events at CMS germanium, then for that mass range, you're going to get plenty of events for CMS silicon.
Did you incorporate the silicon stuff?
Yeah. So silicon is impossible. Like if you're really that low, it's impossible to see.
Well, I mean, yeah.
If you're again,
I think it's right. So I'm saying. So one thing that we could say, since there were some uncertainties in our xenon 10 analysis, if our reanalysis really said, well, actually the CMS silicon is the best limit. And this mass range, then obviously you're going to get plenty of events at CDS silicon with for future runs. So that's the kind of the smoking gun of for those scenarios. Okay.
Great.
All right.
Jacques Aldi movie.
Okay, or do you have your
own? You have your own.
Okay.
Oh, this is
here's one of them. Well, no.
He made you got a mic.
I think this might actually be able to play. Ah, very good.
Superheroes are recommended.
I'll suffer for that.
Yeah, so there'll be some overlap with what I have to say with what Spencer just said, but I'll mostly be talking about the very light dark matter range around, and I mean, by light, I mean quite light, I mean around 10 GeV or so, which is only viable because of this possibility of channeling at Dhamma. But so I was looking at this with Catherine, and we also settled on a mascot who I think.
Channeling is only for if you want to fit Dhamma.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And for the chair would be great. That's right. Channeling is only relevant for Dhamma.
An operational definition of channeling?
Yeah, I'll say what it is. Okay. Yeah, I will. So, but yes, we also chose a mascot, and I think it's safe to say that ours wins. both in physical prowess and in physical knowledge. So, Mr. Fantastic doesn't even have a PhD. So I think Dr. Manhattan just wins, hands down. So this light region of around 10 GeV is interesting for Dhamma because of this channeling possibility, which has been proposed that basically because of the structure of the sodium iodide crystal at Dhamma, it's possible to have much more scintillation light proportional to the recoil energy than for some fraction of events than the ones they measure at higher energies. And so the idea is very simple. If you know one of the iodine atoms, when it gets knocked out of the crystal, if it happens to scatter along one of the axes, then it just travels along and scatters very shallowly off of the atoms in the crystal and loses very little energy in that collision. Most of it just gets lost to the electron cloud. And so the quenching factor for such events, instead of being about 10%, which is what they are for most of Dhamma's events, these could be much closer to 1. And then, the events that Dhamma thought were 20 keV with their 10% quenching factor would actually have been more like 2 keV. And so this allows Dhamma to be sensitive to much lower energies. And this is a sort of tantalizing possibility because it allows you to get around the null constraints from other experiments. Because every other experiment has a threshold in energies. And if you take the dark matter mass to be very light, then those energy thresholds of the other experiments just push the velocity over the escape velocity of the halo. And so they don't see anything at all. And so this is just some kinematics you've all seen a million times, but the minimum velocity for a single event is the momentum transfer, which is just square root of 2 times the nucleus mass times the recoil energy divided by 2 times the reduced mass. And so for a given experiment, like xenon, it has some minimum momentum transfer that measures, and if the dark matter mass is below some critical value, then it just doesn't see anything. And also the effect of channeling on Dhamma is basically, since now you're sensitive to these lower energies, the signal is all coming from these channeled events. And so this is from a paper by Catherine, just takes the Dhamma region for some value of masses and just shifts it down to light masses, and that allows it to edge past these constraints. One thing to keep in mind is
direct evidence for channeling?
Well, so it's not at Dhamma, not in that specific scenario. There is a lot of experimental data on channeling in scenarios where you basically take a block of crystal and you shoot ions down the channel. So it's a real effect, but there are some differences with what's going on at Dhamma. Also, the main difference, I think, is that your recoil is starting from a crystal lattice point, but channeling has been experimentally measured.
I thought they hadn't actually probed it down to those low energies there. Is that true?
They've probed it around those low energies at some other crystals.
For sodium iodide.
I don't think for sodium iodide.
Well, I should say there are old papers on this, and it's not obvious. But there are some papers that don't see channeling too.
Hasn't CDMS tried to look for channeling in germanium and didn't find it?
As a matter of fact, we have down to our lowest thresholds, and what it would look like is a merging of the nuclear recoil band up to the gamma band, and we don't see anything like it, okay? But a careful Monte Carlo deriving a limit has not been done. But if you look at the data, there is no merging of the bands that one would attribute to channeling at low energy.
Yeah.
I think that's
the
That's a good question.
Germanium is a slightly
different structure.
I'm trying
to reboot all I know about this. It takes me a while to remember everything I know about this. And I, of course, perhaps you could comment.
To measure such a step is a quite difficult task, since there are measurements on sodium iodide using neutrons as a beam of particles on nuclei. The only problem is that this effect can give is present just for a few percent of the recoiling nuclei. So this means that you can have a tail in the main port, and all the measurements have this tail, but it's not enough to say that the experiments are seeing channeling effect in sodium iodide. Actually, it's a quite difficult measurements, and there are many people who are thinking about how can make a measurement on this effect on sodium iodide. There are several Monte Carlo and several evaluations, of course.
When I was looking at this, I've got a paper from 1970 where people used heavy ions and fired them at sodium iodide at various crystal alignments. And there is some evidence for channeling. It's some cases modest, but there's certainly the one thing is they're relatively energetic. They're 10 MeV, 7 MeV. They're not down in the KeV.
There's a much more recent paper. It's O2 or something. It's a German group. It's in NIM.
I may have that. I was just trying to reboot it, but did they say anything?
They tried to use 14 MeV neutrons to actually exactly
duplicate.
They didn't see, as Pierre Luigi said, it's an experiment. They didn't see any evidence for channeling.
I might have that. It's taking me a while to get it.
It's Greiken. At all.
It's hard. This is hard. This is really, all those neutron scattering experiments are hard experiments, first of all. Tag each neutron by neutron and know the recoil, and you're just swamped with background from stray neutrons, and these are really hard experiments.
Generally, the output of this experiment is a big peak given by the recoiling, quenched the recoils.
Yes.
And the tail, so that's the problem.
Yes.
The tail is... because the events, the channel of the events are smeared out by the energy resolution of the detector, so it is not so easy to to quantify how much. Yeah.
We'll let you operate under the under channeling.
Yeah.
The silicon line.
Yeah.
I think now it's
exploding. It should be 2/3.
Yeah, this is from Spencer's paper. That's it. The exposure went up by. So what changed with this? So found the exposure went up by an additional 2/3 in exposure. All right, so the silicon, actually, so I did put in some of the things I'll show, I put in some CDMS silicon, but I didn't know about this, so there should be some.
It's not actually published yet, it's in a talk.
Okay, all right.
Right, well, is it?
So, yeah, so one thing we should keep in mind is this is very sensitive. So the DOM fits at these low energies. You're getting this, you're at low energies to push yourself out towards the edge of the halo, so you get this large, this sharp rise at low energies, and so the fits are sort of very sensitive to this lowest energy band. Feynman famously told us we should not read anything into what we see with this lowest energy band. So one thing I haven't done that you might do is just try seeing how the fits in the DOMA region work if you just only include everything else, the chi-squared from every other band. Mostly what I want to say is about the new xenon 10 analysis and how this changes. So I want to talk about how this constraint changes. So Spencer said a little bit about this. I guess I'll say more details. The reason this is such a sensitive issue is because you're very sensitive. The constraints are very sensitive to what this low energy threshold is. So for example, this is from Spencer's old constraint plot from a while ago, but if you take one of these points, which is just sort of close to being excluded, and you look at what the spectrum is at xenon, it's rising very rapidly. And so if their low energy threshold is 3.5 events versus if it's 5.5, you have a very different prediction for how many events you should see. So the new analysis has a much lower energy threshold, but then there's also this L effective measurement that we've heard about, which you also have to take into account. So this is the new xenon 10 analysis where they have nothing here, and they go down to two, around two or so. But the question is what that energy actually corresponds to. And they also, in this region, they're starting to have various cuts, which are cutting off their efficiency. So if you want to be careful about it, then you would want to push this as much as you can and extract as much information, but also put in what those cuts are explicitly. So the three major cuts they have are, first of all, they have this one that they include in their in this table of efficiencies that they include in their recent xenon analysis, which is mostly coming from this this band in log S2 over S1. They're only looking at between the mean and 3 sigma. Then they have an additional S2 cut, which cuts off as a function of energy down here. And then finally, they have an S1 cut, which Peter was telling about, so I took this from his thesis, where their efficiency drops fairly rapidly. But around 2 or so kV, it's not too bad, but it's starting to shut down. And so if you put all of these together, you get something that looks like this. And around 2, the efficiency isn't so much worse than what it is for most of the range. And so this is about what you can go down to. You can push that a little bit lower than 2, but you don't gain a whole lot. But 2 isn't really 2, because there's a new L effective measurement. And so what they've used in the past is 0.19. But then there's this recent measurement, and it drops very rapidly at low energies. So it could be as low as 0.7, and then there's this big error bar. It could even be as low as 0.05. And so then, you know, if it's 0.07, then 2 is actually more like 6. If it's 0.05, 2 is actually more like 8. So we want to put all of this in. So if we do that, this is what we end up getting. So there are a lot of curves here. So this is the CDMS silicon curve. I haven't put in this new the new exposure. This is the DAMA region. This is the 90% and 99% DAMA region. This is the old CDMS germanium. And this is what happens if I take the old xenon analysis and I use the, take the old xenon analysis, but I use their new L effectives. So I can use their measured L effective, which is about 0.07 low energies, or I could be very conservative and use the -1 sigma value and go down to 0.05. And then when you put in the new analysis with no events, then even this very conservative line pretty much cuts out this whole thing. So it's very disfavored, even being, I mean, I think this is quite conservative, taking this -1 sigma, and it still tends to explode this whole thing. One qualitative, sort of quantitative thing I have to say is, just in Spencer's talk, he used 3 kV, so I just wanted to show you how much you gain from going a little bit, trying to push this a little below 3 kV. So their efficiency literally goes to zero at 1.24 kV, so this is the lowest you could even hope to go. And it's not very different from if you go to 2 kV, but you see you do gain a little bit going from about 2 to 3. So I think, you know, you do gain, it is worth it to try and push this a little bit and include their efficiencies. That's it. So that's basically, I think, maybe if you try and throw out the lowest DAMA bin and use this -1 sigma curve, then maybe you could get a little bit of this DAMA region open, parameter space opening up, but it seems like xenon rules this out. That's it.
Michael.
Yeah.
All this analysis you did, also this is true also for the previous talk, have been made using always the same, for instance, certain L model, maybe you assume it's isothermal sphere.
Yeah.
Distribution. Assuming the form factor maybe from L, and several other things, for instance, the quenching factor, DAMA, I don't know which number, maybe the central value we published 10 years ago, and so on. And in such a way, you don't consider at all any kind of uncertainties which exist on all these parameters. For instance, it is not written in every book that the quenching factor, the form factors, for instance, of these interactions is given by the simple form of the Helmholtz form factor. There are many other parameterization and many other things that...
But I think the variations in the different form factors are not very big at this point, right? So I'm using, for this I'm using the 2-parameter Fermi, but it's a tiny difference from the Helm form factor thing. The halos, if the halo model is a little broader, I think you could push this region a little bit down. If it's tighter, so the kind of things that Anil and Mike Kulin posted the other day, I think, tend to move it the other direction. Another thing you could try and do to move this region back in is if the dark matter has some structure. So if there's some momentum dependence in the dark matter, that will tend to push this in, and that might be able to open up this possibility again.
For instance, the quenching factor, so...
Hugely in terms of understanding the style and being able to see what happens to those QKVs. But if on the other hand, it turns back up or, you know, something, the first time doing something wrong, so it's been.
But as far as the quenching factor uncertainties, I think I'm taking them all into account pretty conservatively, because the only ones that are relevant are DAMA, which I'm taking to be 1. It can't be more than 100%. And then xenon, I'm already pushing it to quite low.
For instance, you see the case of xenon. Up to 1 year ago, you are making such analysis, you use different kind of, without considering that some parameter can have uncertainties. In fact, with the new analysis, the LF value changes, And therefore, also the
yeah, I completely changes. I completely agree. You should include uncertainties in L-effective, but
these bounds are not, how can say, universal bounds. They can change, changing the measurement of the leaders. And I'm stress again that the form factors is not the Hermann form factor. Actually, we don't know because there are no measurements on the form factor.
I think for xenon there are measurements of the form factor, right?
Yeah, but this depends. It is not completely decoupled from the particle. Depends also on the kind of particle you interact with. If it is neutron, okay, but there are many other candidates, and then.
Well, and as you said, if you have a momentum-dependent interactions, then this is going to change. So I think he's just staying within one. Particular model framework and seeing how things change as you change the I think the main point is
one particular model.
Yeah, it's definitely one particular model. Yeah, Liam is actually can because Nima's going to end up talking for about an hour. can I go ahead and let us
Yeah, one of the things I've
he's not.
Yeah, one of the things I've tried to stress previously, not now, is that if there is some structure in the dark matter, if there's some momentum dependence, that can push this in and that can help you. I just haven't I didn't have time to do that analysis for today.
Thanks. Okay, Fran, you want to come up and
yeah.
You're going to be on the board?
Yeah.
I'm going to ask a question about the channel. So can you give me my Rossi-Elder Monte Carlo
we can make 11 years at 20 degrees and have it. That's good idea.
Now, how do I get these on? One of these lights, someone's going to know. Or do I just randomly? Oh.
Well, you have to give them a chance. Oh.
Okay, so since everyone seems to have a mascot, I'm going to tell you. Actually, even before I get to get into this. So, by the way, this has been a really useful workshop for me, and I'm really delighted to be here. I'm hoping I'm going to get the CDMS result, but I have a plane at 3:30, so we'll see if I can stick around until they actually give us the juice. So.
They'll tell you on the plane, like, you know, sometimes like these sports scores.
Yeah, I'm going to be the one they're forcing to turn the cell phone off. But anyway, so just literally just like 1 to 2 days ago, Patty, Tim, and I were thinking about what is the most trivial statement you can make about potential observations of nuclear recoils interpreted as WIMPs. I mean really the most trivial statement you can make. So with that in mind, then the mascot for I think this thing is this. Okay. So there's my mascot, stick man, meaning literally that. Okay. So this is no meat on this at all. Okay. Let's see. So, two observations. Number one is, which one do I want to do first? I'll do this one first. The first observation is the famous rate of events in a detector, and I'm going to write the rate in the following way. The rate is the density of dark matter, some crap, okay? Then there is some velocity distribution, DIST. There is a cross section, and a nuclear form factor. Okay, and And of course, what we get is number of events, and we get their energies. So that much we get. If we know their energies, then up to some residual uncertainties of nuclear form factors, that tells us that. This density we learned from a couple of days ago is bounded to within maybe a factor of 2, maybe better, 1.5 or so, at least locally. The average number at our radius, the average number at our radius is bounded to be in sort of that range. But if you see events that are interpreted as WIMPs, okay, so it tells you something about this. But in fact, you already see just right here, right, that if you don't know what this thing is, you can't extract this number. Just that very trivial statement alone, right? So to the extent that this could be much larger or much smaller than what we actually observe, then the extracted cross section you get out is different, right? All of these exclusion curves always assume some canonical value for this, but we don't know what the number is, right? So you don't fundamentally know what this cross section.
Grams, the much smaller number is more justifiable because you can have a scattering on a very subdominant component of dark matter, right?
A very subdominant component of dark matter.
There are multiple components of dark matter.
I'm not even there. Right. Yeah. Right. Then the other big one, of course, is this, right, is the velocity distribution. And there we also saw from a couple of days ago, you know, these wonderful simulations of what it looks like. And here's going to be my interpretation is roughly something like this with lots of wiggles over here. This is the velocity distribution of dark matter in the galactic frame, okay, for now. Do I have this right? The other one. There we go. V and number or something, okay? Yeah, something like that. Interestingly, let me make one first trivial statement right away. If you had elastic scattering, right, if you have elastic scattering, then, right, we all know this famous formula of the velocity, the minimum velocity to scatter, right, looks like that, the nucleon mass, the recoil energy, the reduced mass. So then you can just ask, okay, so suppose the mass of dark matter is really large, you can then this is completely determined by whatever nuclei you have, the germanium or xenon. How many people know where is the minimum velocity for a given recoil energy? Right, you know, off the top of your head, I didn't know what this was. Okay, and so the number is that for low recoil energies of order, you know, 10 keV, it's down sort of about here on this curve. And if you're up at like 100 keV recoil energy, you're more at about there, right? And I'm drawing this up because this is V min, right? So the point is you're never sampling down here. So this is entirely irrelevant, right, to the whole story of dark matter direct detection. Okay, so that's number one. The second big thing, of course, is that there's usually, right, it's usually phrased that there is a cutoff on the velocity distribution, typically taken to be, right, the escape velocity of dark matter. So yesterday I was probing with Louis about this number. What can this number be? You know, could it be slightly larger, 10% larger? Of course, he told me, oh, it can be much larger. We don't, you know, if you just think about astrophysics, it can be much larger. So I don't know exactly what to interpret about this, but obviously this plays a large role in understanding, you know, what are the kinematics of the events. Yeah. But after all, this came from n-body simulations, right? This came from n-body simulations. So, you know, we have no direct experimental information on this. There's some, you know, probably phrased appropriately, or at least I'm going to phrase it as a particle physicist, weak astrophysical information that gives us a constraint on V escape. Okay. Oh, see, you're taking it even lower than I would take it, I think. Okay, you're saying, I don't know. Okay, circumstantial weak, but you know, you get the idea. And then again, of course, this number is somewhere in the range of between 500 to say 650 kilometers per second, if I remember the units right. There we go. All right. Yeah. So we got that much. Now, just stare at, so if you stare at this and at these numbers and this min, then you see that for a fixed recoil energy, so now you go off to an experiment. Well, rather than taking a hypothetical experiment, imagine you go directly to the xenon experiment. And there they have some band, which I don't remember what it looks like, but I had it on the computer. It doesn't matter. Something like this. The reanalysis that Peter did, you've seen it twice or three times now up on the screen. Roughly speaking, to a theorist, it looks like this. That's all that I care about. Huh? What?
It looks that way to me too.
Yeah. Of which this energy, and I'm reading very crudely off the plot, was about 62 keV. This one was about 52 keV. Okay. So then, you've got energies. You could then say, well, consider the following statement, right? Suppose I want to take one of these events and I say this is really genuinely a wind scatter. What do I learn from it? And just kinematics, just pure kinematics, right? So you take one of these events and you plug in an energy, and from that, if you think there is some, you know, there is some, well, from that you can extract what the minimum velocity would have to be. And so then, if this velocity is larger than some, say, the escape velocity, then that immediately tells you, okay, this event is not consistent with whatever mass you had plugged in here.
Of course, you shouldn't be taking the escape velocity, right?
You shouldn't be taking the escape velocity, but...
You should be taking the escape velocity plus 230.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Very good, very good, very good. Yeah, so I didn't even say that, but yeah. this V min, how do I want to say this? Let me phrase it in the following way. If I take fixed recoil energy, this is a fixed quantity, then mu is the reduced mass. If I expand this out, it looks like ER over 2MN, I think to the 1/2 power, 1 plus M, where am I here? M.
Pushing you along.
It's almost done. Maybe to the 1/2 power, but I think this is the other way around. This is in the large, okay, in the large dark matter mass limit, and then in the small one, well, then obviously this just goes to the dark matter mass. But then the idea is what, all right? So the idea is that for a fixed recoil energy, yeah, if I go to If I imagine I want to get a constraint on the mass of dark matter extracted out of this, right? So as I lower the mass, right, I'm increasing the minimum velocity eventually to a point where it will exceed V galactic escape plus the sun, right? Just that simple statement. So from that, then you can say that in a worst case scenario, if all the dark matter had this velocity, right, then what you do, what you get out of that is a lower bound of the mass of dark matter. So what's that number? So we just did that, and I'll just give you the result. We did it actually in two cases. I've shown you the case for purely elastic, but you can do it for inelastic. In fact, inelastic is very easy to see what it is. The V min for inelastic is just V min of elastic, okay, plus delta times crap. Okay. So in the limit that delta goes to zero, right, it goes over. But the idea is it's a positive constant times delta, right? It's a positive constant times delta, which just means that inelastic minimum is always smaller than that of the elastic, if I've done this correctly. No, but it's positive. It's positive, but it's positive. That's important, right? Okay, so then if you do this, what you end up with is you can get a number for the mass, for the dark matter mass in this result, and you can get a number, say, from xenon, right? And that's sort of an amusing number. So the number we got was, if you interpret, doesn't really matter which point you want to take, but if you take the highest energy point or the next one down, you get a number that is in the ballpark of 20 to 25 GeV. If you want an exact number, I got to read it off from the plot, and I can't read it that closely, so, okay? And then if you do this as a function of delta, this is the inelastic parameter, which Neil's going to talk about just after me, right? Or one after me or something, anyway. And then you do this as a function of the mass of dark matter, then you get a curve, and it looks something like this. And if you want to put some meat on this, then the curve actually goes, sorry, let me get this out here. What this depends on, of course, is exactly what you choose for this escape velocity. So you bound this in some way, and you're going to get a couple of curves. You get one that maybe looks like this. Another one maybe looks like that. I haven't even superimposed them, so I don't know whether I've superimposed them properly. Okay, it does something like that. And then this is the bound in the limit that you go purely elastic, and then as you go up, this is in the inelastic regime. And once you get this, you know, so there's some number on the mass, and then this number that you get out of here is, you know, ballpark 20 GeV. Okay, and this is with this, you know, completely, totally crazy assumption that all of the dark matter is moving with the escape velocity, right? Now, obviously, if it moves lower, then all of the bounds get stronger, right? And then everything goes stronger. But what I've just said here is just purely, you know, this is first year undergraduate mechanics, okay, that has gotten this number out. But it's a number that is completely independent of all of this other stuff. Now, if you were to say something like, well, wait a second, we know that there is, you know, there's no events, say, in this range. Doesn't that tell me something? No. Model independently, it tells me nothing because there could be a form factor here that suppresses those events. It could be inelastic that suppresses those events. And so on. You could say, well, wait a second, what about Xeon sees this, but okay, CDMS has a bound. What do I care about that? Well, PADI has a model in which it's resonant dark matter where it only interacts with one type of nucleus. So that's totally model dependent. So you can't take any of these constraints. So in the end, the amount of information you can get out of this is not, it's seemingly not very much, but you get some really sort of interesting information, the bound on the mass, and then you get and you can get also some sort of bound in the cross section, which. Once you have events interpreted as WIMP recoils.
For inelastic, you could use the lowest event also and figure out what that means for the mass.
Yes, you could. Yes, so. Yes. I think we look, well, anyway, okay. Offline, I can tell you about.
Thanks. So, in the spirit of an impromptu open mic, Darius, why don't you tell us the CDMS results?
Fantastic.
Yeah, just with CDMS results. Okay.
I take lots of being responsible and say,
so I think you have to be recorded.
Okay. All right, that's fine.
You need to say something.
You don't have to be recorded.
Yeah, if you need to say something, not recorded.
No, this is not. This is not. Yeah. Okay. No, I'm not gonna.
You can just whisper to me. I gotta catch a plane.
Okay. Am I gonna be okay here on? Protect displays, where's the, okay, so let's see if this works. If I just go to,
I think inbox.
This, yeah, I could, definitely I could show you the talk, but I won't. Whoa, no. Okay, so what am I doing here?
Is it plugged in? The battery's plugged
back. Oh yeah, okay, I'll do that.
Yeah, okay.
But this is on the low threshold sort of thing. No, stop that, okay. Okay, so this is low mass threshold CDMS work, and we have a terrific student, Ray Bunker, who, you know, all of us should encourage him to finish this work because we all want to know, right, at low mass. I mean, we all want to know something else, I suppose, but we want to know what's happening at low mass for WIMPs, okay? And, you know, you should have no doubt that everyone in these collaborations is always thinking of what other, where can you push the envelope to look for new signals? We're always obsessing over that. So low threshold is one of the obvious places, right? So this is Ray Bunker's work. So this was CDMS when we were at Stanford, and there must be a pointer somewhere. Where did it go? I can use this. Okay. SUF. So we operated in a relatively shallow site at at Stanford, about in our language, 17 meters water equivalent. We're at about 2,000 meters water, 2 to 3,000 water. What's that? 2,000. Yeah, 2,000. I did remember it right. Okay, meters water equivalent at Sudan. But the great thing about the Stanford site was how low noise it was, and that enabled us to do the lowest threshold. And now there is something to say here. How does CDMS trigger you know, how do we decide to record an event? And we just make that decision based on the phonon signal. Okay, and that's because, as you know, for nuclear recoils, there's less charge ionization, and so you don't want to trigger on that. You want to trigger on the phonons. And so we, like all good experiments, we take certain samples of our data that where the trigger is not required, and then we study in that sample how often there is a trigger as a function of the energy that we reconstruct. So there's sort of a well-known methodology for figuring out your trigger efficiency as a function of deposited energy. And this energy is definitely nuclear recoil energy, not the other energy that we can have, which is electron recoil energy, if you like. Okay. So that's what's along the horizontal axis here. This is real data from Stanford, and this is the efficiency. And the main thing is you can see the threshold is about 7/10 of a kV. So that's something to know. What is our real trigger threshold? It's 7/10 of a kV, at least in our quietest data sets. And then, it's kind of interesting. It rises very quickly. This is sort of, I believe this is a one pulse triggering, one quadrant of our experiment. Our detectors have four quadrants. If one quadrant starts to stick up above the noise, we trigger. When you get to relatively bigger pulses, all four quadrants start contributing, and their timing is a little off. So when we're in hardware, when we're at the trigger of the experiment, we have a way of adjusting for timing, if you like. And so what's happening here is multiple quadrants are contributing. When we trigger online, we don't quite add them up right, and our efficiency is a little lower. But it's still high. I mean, it's still high efficiency. But it takes a little while. It takes till about 2.5 kV to get to 100%. So this is kind of a nice, useful plot to really know how we trigger. And this is the work of Ray Bunker and is very near being released. But there's always something to argue about. And one thing we argue about is, what is the turn-on like there? So that's what this thing is. This is blow up that region and make the horizontal axis on top now. And as far as we can tell, when the our trigger efficiency is the blue line, and it really goes to zero at half a kV. We're really a dead zero. This is vertical scale, and it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, 20 orders of magnitude. We don't have 20 orders of magnitude. We don't have a mole of events, so we don't really measure to that. But our functions extend that low. Okay. And the red is error bars and so forth. Okay, so that's just a blow up of that region. One thing that does happen, and that we are, trying to do the right thing, it takes a while to do this really right. It's of course possible for a nuclear recoil to happen, let's say with 0.45 kV, pick up a little noise and trigger the experiment. I mean, this is a well-known effect in all sorts of experiments in the world. Okay, that is what we trigger on is a measured energy, not a true energy. Okay, and we want to take that into account. We want to do a careful job of exploring, what is the efficiency for tiny pulses to get kicked up above threshold, and that takes a long time to convince everybody you got that right. So that's one thing about the low pulse site. So this is germanium again too. I should say we have similar thing. It will include silicon and. For recoils, silicon, for low mass recoils, silicon can be better, actually. It's an interesting thing to know. Okay, all right. So just to show the performance of the detector, here is energy. What's along the vertical is yield, which is our space, where gammas are a yield of 1. And then this is the nuclear recoil band. And this looks a little different because we have a logarithmic energy scale along the horizontal. Normally, we show a linear scale from, with a threshold at about 10 kV for the Sudan data up to 100 kV. Now, look, there's a whole new decade and beyond on the horizontal scale of this plot. So this is for Stanford data. And then you see the gammas, the Compton recoils, but you also see there's a few lines here. And this is what a gamma line looks like when we do the reconstruction of it. There's details as to why it's on a funny hyperbolic curve, but okay. This is a 10 kV line from electron capture in a germanium isotope that we get by neutron activation when we shine neutrons on the experiment. And that's the capture from the L shell. There's also capture from the K shell, so it's about 10 kV. There's also capture from the L shell at 1 kV. So what's nice here is there's a 1 kV line that's really sitting there in the data. And it's sort of, we like this because it shows how beautiful our low energy sensitivity is. Now, for the Sudan data, we just aren't showing this yet. It'll get shown eventually, but it just isn't. It isn't shown yet. Okay.
Harry, how do I understand why there aren't any there are fewer confidants between those lines?
Very good question. Okay. Very good question. All right. As far as I know, there's a little bit, you start to run into real atomic physics in Compton scattering. There's the binding energy of the electrons in the atom. So you're not Compton scattering off a Fermi sea of electrons.
Can you produce that shape?
Qualitatively, we have. I don't think they're Monte Carlo. I mean, you got to do the whole atomic physics of Compton scattering off bound state electrons. I believe that's the answer. That's been the answer we always say, okay. And it is interesting. I mean, they're
been done by someone.
Yeah. Very, very good question, but that's our explanation, okay, is that you have to include, because look at the recoils are becoming comparable to the atomic structure energies. So you better do Compton, and you know, there are people who do this, it's buried in old papers that once I studied for magnetic monopole searches of all things, but that's something else, okay. But that's the explanation for that, okay. But look at this line, I mean, it's not an experimental acceptance issue. I mean, that's why I really like this plot. It shows, look, we're triggering and accepting 1 kV lines. Okay, that's not an issue. This is the nuclear recoil band, and that's the last. Let me see. Is that the last thing? No. I want to show if this plot always has some combination of an ionization measurement to make the yield, and the horizontal is the pure nuclear recoil part of the phonons, which that's a detail that, you know, one can ask about, because what happens is the ionization in our detectors, when it's being collected, emits phonons. You know, and those phonons shouldn't count somehow. Those are phonons that are the result of the ionization. So somehow in subtracting those out, we end up with these lines, and that's what the horizontal axis is. It's the nuclear recoil part of the phonons, not the phonons that come from drifting the ionization, which are called Luke phonons. Okay, so that complicates things. But anyway, if we just plot this as a function of these things, as a function of total phonons, you see this beautiful line at about 1.3 or so keV, and those are some resolutions. And it varies detector by detector. Our resolution gets as good as, you know, 140 eV or so in phonons. And the fact that there are different resolutions has to do with the position dependence of things in our detectors. Okay, that we try to correct the position dependence as best we can, but sometimes it's a little bit of a challenge. When we really get it right, get down to resolutions that are sort of like that. So that's what we can do at low threshold.
Harry, what's the difference between the low energy threshold at Stanford versus in Vermont?
We have a little more noise at Sudan because the system was sort of designed for a lot more channels. And there's, you know, a lot more just electrical, ground, you know, all the usual stuff we never talk about in public, okay? You know, noise, ground loops, noise and ground loops, okay? More noise and more ground loops.
How tired is it?
You know, we're clear by 10 kV. And, you know, what we're, I think for SUF data, we published on, Ray, tell me what our threshold at SUF was for the
5
kV. So you crudely a factor of 2 worse at Sudan. So it's not, you know how it is. I mean, you sit there and the experiment has been undressed and re-put together 2 or 3 times to reduce noise, by the way. Okay. Again, unmentionable things in the real world. But we all know, everyone who's built these experiments know you do that. It's gross and awful, and we do it, okay. All right, so the last thing involves, this is a neutron calibration at Stanford. Shown, look how low, again, below 10 to 1 to below. Okay, these are the neutron calibration nuclear recoils. And of course, it's done with a californium source, which is a fission source, so lots of gammas get emitted too. It's not a pure neutron source. There's always beaucoup gammas. The gammas show this kind of cutoff, Dan, okay, that we, you know, I think is atomic physics. But look at the neutrons. These are nuclear recoils from neutrons. And the qualitative thing one is looking for channeling is a population of these that just start to go up and become gammas. That's what channeling would look like, okay? And I don't know, you know, do you see it? Okay. You know, we could start discussing this, and, you know, this might be something related to the 46 kV lead 210 line. That feature is probably, you know, it's about the right place to have something to do with some of our surface contamination, okay? But we look at the this plot and say, okay, maybe germanium, you know, isn't so good at channeling. Okay.
Can I add something?
Yeah.
Well, there is also another effect together with the channeling, which is the blocking effect. This has been studied by Rachella Gelmini.
Yes, she's talked to me a lot about that.
And in such case, since the recoil is starting from a location of where is the nucleus, of course,
right,
it's very difficult that this nucleus can enter in the channel.
Right.
In fact,
if you had a nucleus that was sitting in the channel to begin with, that you
temperature is very low, and the nucleus is perfectly placed in the location of the crystal, of the lattice.
Yeah.
Why, in case of the temperature is high, as for instance in the case of solid scintillator, solid iodide, cesium iodide, and so on, the nucleus is not in the location of the lattice, and therefore it's much more easy that it can enter inside the channel. Yeah. This has been studied by Monte Carlo, as far as I understand, from Graziella Gemini, and
So somehow KT is bumping your nuclei out into the channel. That's the idea somehow, that, you know, that at low temperature the nuclei live in their rows and columns, and then add some KT and they get out a little bit with some simple harmonic sort of.
Okay.
I haven't sat and played with that, but that's an interesting comment. Yeah, there's some argument that if you're kicking a nucleus that's in its crystal location, it has real trouble finding its way to a channel. That's the sort of problem, the big problem that's here. Anyway, so this is what we have to do is get a model, including all that, and fit it to this, and come up with a limit on how much channeling they can be. And that, we haven't done that. Neil, is that in the spirit of okay. Thank you. Yeah. All right.
I'm going to be very quick.
Yeah, I'm trying to.
There you go. Thanks.
No, thanks.
I'm going to very, very quickly take us through
an inelastic.
Oh yeah, one of those. I think those are actually all on. I think the actual light we want to turn off is one of those back there, around the corner. Yeah.
Was it an elastic interaction?
This is. You can turn those back on, but the one that there's one magical one which is here. Excuse me for a second. Okay. Can you turn those back ones on? Good. All right. Well, anyway. So I'm just going to take you very, very quickly through Team Inelastic. This is my mascot. This is a Ferrari that crashed into a pole in Perth, Australia. There's no relevance. So the reason why I can be very quick, I want to talk about the relevance of inelastic dark matter for CDMS. And the reason why I can be very quick is that the basic predictions of IDM for CDMS are nothing in particular. Inelastic dark matter, remember, is this scenario where you have dark matter which kicks into an excited state. It's been talked about a decent amount, so I'm not going to go into the details. And so you can have this problem that is you don't know what the kinematics are going to be, so you don't actually have any guarantees that CDMS will see anything at all in this kind of a setup. But that won't stop me from keeping on talking. But the first requirement to note is just that there is some range of parameters for which there's just going to be no inelastic scattering at CDMS. So this is your delta, this is your dark matter mass, and basically on this side of the lines, then you can scatter. On this side of the lines, you can't scatter. And then this is just depending on whether you take your escape velocity to be 500, 550, or 600. So there's some nebulous zone here where it might happen or might not happen, and then here it won't happen, and here it will happen. And this is maybe a bit more quantified if you look at this plot that Mike showed. Just a light
WIMP case and a heavy WIMP case. And so on these plots, this dark black line here is the current CDMS limit. And that means that, okay, so like if you're living here, then if it moves down, then, you know, then that's great. And if you're living here, then it's great. And if you're living here, then nothing's going to happen. But let's assume that you do see something. The main thing is that the spectrum should be peaked, right? So any signal that you would see from IDM would be peaked. So I kind of wanted to ask the question, where could a peak live and it still be sort of something that we would think about as one of these models? Well, if you look at, say, I've just picked two that are sort of like the wide range, heavy, light, chosen some various values of delta from something which is very low to something that is very high. And you can see that some sort of peak starting at about 20 would be the lowest possible thing, and it could basically peak all the way up to the end of your experiment. So what do we think about the possibility for inelastic scattering? I'm an optimist by my nature, so I thought that I would start with the optimistic points. There have been three CDMS releases up to this point. The first one was this 19.4 kilogram days, and this doesn't look like an optimistic smiley face plot, but if you actually go and you read the paper, they say this algorithm, the algorithm, the pulse fitting algorithm, gives it some blah blah. We've also formed a second non-blind analysis using the intended pulse fitting algorithm with the same blind cuts resulting in a 5% and a event at 64 keV. So the way I read that is that they really wanted this event in their data set, so I have added it in there. The second thing is that there was a second run of 34 kilogram days, and so they had three events that passed the timing cuts, this one here, this one there, and this one here. And this one here looks to me right on the edge. And who knows, really, they don't have that many neutrons, they don't have that many events when you get to the, this is their acceptance region, and you know, you don't have as many neutrons up here to calibrate, so maybe they don't know this as well, so it's on the board, I'm gonna take it too. So that's the optimistic side. Let's move on to the pessimistic side.
What's the energy cell?
This is about 55. Oh yeah, sorry, I blocked up. This is about 55 keV.
What about the stars then?
Mm-hmm. This is 10.5 keV. This is about 10.5 keV. I'm taking it, but it doesn't actually say anything for inelastic. If you read the paper, if you read the paper, basically they say this event they meant to have, but they shouldn't. This one they don't think is there. There was I believe something with the muon veto that wasn't working as well at that moment. So, but they keep it in anyway. So the negative sides, we have their slightly larger 121.3 kilogram day run, which saw nothing. And then we have Edelweiss, which looks at high energies and also sees nothing. So that's a lot of nothing. So if I decide to be optimistic, and I think of this as 335 kilogram day total, then I do the same game that Spencer and Itai did. That's two events. I'll take an upper limit, 90% of 5.3. I'll multiply that by some expected exposure, and you get something like a possible expected value of 3.2 events. Maybe I'm a little more optimistic than that because you can kind of look at when they ran, and maybe it's a little bit more in the summer, and these data tend to be very, very modulated. So you might get some boost from running more in the summer. So, if you're in this kind of model, will all of your events be at high energy? Well, because I'm not ready to give up on inelastic just yet. No, the events don't have to all be at high energy because a lot of models will have some elastic scattering in there. For instance, mixed neutrinos have a Higgs exchange. You can have second order scattering. Second order scattering in just inelastic models doesn't give you a large enough scattering cross section. Maxime looked at this, but something that Phil pointed out to me that if you had a different interaction that you move through, like moving to a 1 MeV state, like in XDM models, then maybe you could have a large enough interaction rate that we would see. So if I combine those together, then this is now the prediction for what CDMS should see. Some combination, this is a 70, 250, 1000. I've just chosen the parameters by hand to sort of make it flattish. And then, of course, you could imagine that now you dial up your delta and you completely remove the inelastic scattering and all you're left with is an inelastic scattering signal. So that's sort of the range of possibilities. It can, you know, you can dial it to the situation where it looks just like a team elastic. So
let me just tell you what the conclusions are. I'm obviously hoping for a lot of inelastic scatterings. So what would you expect? Well, first of all, you would expect a peak with the events dominantly occurring in the summer. The second thing, though, is that it's not entirely obvious what a peak looks like if we're talking about, you know, somewhere below, you know, five events. That's not obvious what a peak even means. The second thing is that you could imagine, though, the second possibility, that you'd have a falling spectrum from the elastic scattering bit, and then you have an inelastic scattering piece, and then so you'd have these two pieces. And that's absolutely impossible to see with the statistics we're going to talk about. That wouldn't look like anything. Or, you know, should I be forced into this corner, it could just look like elastic scattering. If the inelastic, and this is not impossible, this is certainly not impossible. And in that case, we just will have to wait for Xenon 100 to tell us the rest of the story. So that's everything I wanted to say. Thanks. Yes. Doug, do you want to come get set up?
Did I tell you to release the timing?
Or do you want me to let Gordy go now? If you want a few more minutes.
Yeah, my talk's getting better and better.
Gordy, why don't you come set up? Sorry, Patty, go ahead.
So Gordy's done with his. He should.
Oh, well, we certainly asked. We asked Blas if he would be telling us the dates and, you know, in standard, you know, CDMS this week fashion. He said, hmm.
That's a standard answer.
let's go up. Let's go ahead and go use your, if that's okay, or just, sure. Because this is keynote.
Where's that button?
Be a really good talk. So Harry, are you going to give us, if there were to be events at CDMS, are you going to give us the dates and the when they occurred?
How can I answer this in a way? I should say dates of all events are known.
Okay. Dates of all events
and times.
Of all events in the nuclear or non-nuclear
in the whole experiment
are known. And if we were to ask you about, say, a particular electron scattering, you might be willing to go back and look and tell us what the data that was.
Post-unblinding, all sorts of questions can be answered given people's time. And even the person on shift can be identified.
Is there a correlation with the person?
Who knows? I hate to say this, but occasionally Captain Fantastic was on ship. He had his own dark halo.
It's a little small. We can discuss.
Nemo actually over that. 2.5 hours.
The V-squared.
The velocity spread will last scatter.
Oh, yeah.
It's coming.
No, you didn't.
You know, can I ask a quick question about the
welcome to our
fluorine? Is there a significant range of parameters for which the form factor can mimic the inelastic signal?
The actual form factor, like the nuclear form factor?
No, like the dark matter form factor.
Oh, well, so you should ask Liam. Liam and collaborators have constructed scenarios that do that. The main way that you tell the difference between those sorts of things is that if it's really just dependent on the Q squared, then you just see the signal move around with Q squared. So as the target nucleus moves around, then you can see it. Whereas if it's an inelastic scattering, it moves around based on kinematics. Good point either way. Well, they take a really light, so it modulates a lot.
So I'm coming from quite a different point of view. We know like LIDA superpartners are well motivated theoretically, and we've shown that they can describe the PAMELA data if they're in a mass range like this. So what I'm just going to do in 5 minutes is look at what kinds of recoil distributions and rates we can get under those conditions for CDMS and xenon. This is all stuff we've looked at in the last few days, so it's preliminary. The purpose of this is just to show you that if this is the PAMELA data, if the LIDA superpartner mass, we know like one, is sort of in this range, then it can give an okay description of the PAMELA data. These are curves that are normalized to the local density and have no boost factors. So that's the assumptions of this kind of analysis.
Have you put in possible?
No. This is just to show you the mass range that could make sense and nothing else. So we have a comic book character too. This is obviously invented about dark matter. In 1982, this comic character was invented and is to keep track of dark matter things. And here he's checking the PAMELA satellite to make sure it's working okay. Danger Mouse is his fake name, but dark matter is what he's there for. So here, I just take a 170 GeV dark matter particle. The red line is the recoil distribution you would get from that. And so you can see the range, like maybe you can't see that too well. Here's 20, 40, 60 keV. For our numbers, about 84% would be below 50 keV from this distribution. And Josh Ruderman is more or less consistent with these numbers that we got. And just for comparison, if it was a 60 GeV one, you would get instead 91%, and it's not so easy to tell the difference at this stage. But eventually, you can guess that with some number of events of the order of 50, you could actually tell the difference. This particular graph is from a 94% Weino 1 in the LIDA superpartner wave function, and it's got Higgs-Zeno amounts mixed in.
Probably 94%, right?
94.94 squared. Yes, thank you. This is the equation for the linear case. Pure Weinos don't scatter, and so the size of the cross-section is determined by the Higgs-Zeno contributions, but that has to be an amount that's small to be consistent with the PAMELA analysis, which is a constraint on this. These are the annihilation and scattering cross-sections for this stuff.
What's your thumb?
It doesn't matter much for this in practice for this analysis, but it's low. It's near two. And this is the prediction for xenon and the comparison. The red line is the germanium, and the blue is the xenon comparison. And the number of events per kilogram per day in this bin from 10 to 50 is here for this example. So we will write all this down and make the predictions analytic and clear and a little more consistent. These graphs were done quickly and aren't completely all with the same assumptions, but we'll have that available. Well, here it is for the CDMS data. We won't have it published before today, but for xenon we will. So that's all I want to say.
With this additional PAMELA point that we saw last week, can you still get a Weino model that's just more massive?
It goes through those fine. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, it works fine with that.
The basic point is that it hasn't turned out for us because the mass is so if it were rising, we'd have a problem.
Kind of can't handle the adapter. Do you need
just the usual big one? Well, this is the old one.
So Doug is going to give us a very exciting talk. Doug has actually gotten access to the events of some sort. And is going to.
You weren't supposed to tell him that.
And they were ones and zeros, and that's all he could tell.
He hasn't really gotten access to the events.
Stream of ones and zeros.
All right.
All right. Open mic night. So the other mic in the room sent me a list of bets. So because this is very important to see what people's bets would actually imply for the data, I guess this is the what did I say? what I'm going to do is show you some of the bets here and what they look like in the inelastic parameter space, the sigma delta m space.
The inelastic parameter space, including delta equals zero.
Yes. Oh, yes. Elastic is a trivial subspace of the much richer, more interesting inelastic space. So we'll start with Catherine here because she. Leonidas was my office mate for 4 or 5 years, and he never looked that good. I mean, Catherine said 11 and 20 kV. All right. What that implies in the, I should explain the six panels here. Okay, so we compute the likelihood in the three-dimensional sigma mass delta for these two events given half count background on germanium in an unnamed experiment. And then we can marginalize over mass or over sigma or over delta and plot the other two parameters. So if you were only interested in elastic case, you would just root off the delta equals zero. Then over here, what we're doing is we have just the slice through the best point, the highest likelihood point in the space. So we cut through the sigma delta, mass delta, and so on planes. Couple comments. The blue and the red. The blue is the X marks the spot of the maximum likelihood. The red square is the marginalized best likelihood. Okay, so you marginalize out two dimensions and ask where is the best likelihood in the third. And so, of course, they don't land on each other. They would if you had a nice Gaussian thing, but we don't. So, and I'm just, for the marginalization, I'm just taking flat priors in whatever you see. So it's flat in delta, but flat in log mass and log sigma. The final note is sigma is not sigma, obviously. It says arbitrary units, but it's worse than that. Actually, by that axis, I just mean the thing in front of the rate equation. I'm not worrying about all the, all the extra factors.
White is higher likelihood.
White is more likelihood, yes. So these curves are.
The X is in the gray area.
These curves should roughly correspond to 1, 2, 3, and 4 sigma.
Does that mean there's a very small...
So remember, these are marginalized, and these aren't. So you'll see that the blue X is actually in the white area and all of these, because these are the slices through the best part of the space. But then when you take the whole space and project it, they aren't necessarily anymore. So just, what's your best answer? It depends what you mean and what you're trying
so
to do.
So Catherine wants a WIMP that's between...
You mean Leonidas.
And, yes. And these are Catherine's WIMPs, right?
Yeah, these are actually Catherine's
WIMPs. So Catherine wants something which is between maybe 15 and, 35?
Something like that. Yeah, I think, something like that.
All right.
So that's the content of this exercise, right? You're telling us what we meant by our bets.
We're just playing around here to see what your bets
are. We're also seeing if you had this data set, what kind of information could you extract?
Exactly. And from only two events, you can't extract much. Like, you're still totally consistent with delta equals zero, so it's totally uninteresting. So now for the next one. Mike Coolin, who is actually this guy, he said 12, 18, and 27. And you see the contours maybe got a little tighter, moved to the right a little. But there's not that much difference here. Okay, so moving along, the real Leonidas Moustakas wanted four events. I mean, this is just extravagant, I think, to want four events, really. But they're free. So you see the contours got a little tighter again. Things are still very consistent with the elastic case. We don't have all day, so I'm going to move ahead to Patty now. Patty went way out on a limb here. It's like 62. Okay, but you never know. Like Neil said, there was already that 65 kV event or 64 or whatever. So maybe that's what Patty had in mind. And the fit seems to be saying no thanks, because if the expectation value for the background is 0.5, the fit has no trouble saying, well, that's not liar, forget about it. So if you just put in one high event like that, it doesn't really push the likelihood zero. However, and this is just showing if we go to one count instead of a half, that's even more true. Right? So this is very background sensitive. The only difference between these two is the estimate of the background. But you see the central values, or best values, move in addition to the fit becoming, what's the word? Crap. So, Graham, just, I don't know, this is just crap. So now, Graham didn't make a bet. That was only put there for humorous purposes. So now let's go to a guy who actually knows what he's talking about. He said 15, 22, 32, 45. I mean, it must be right. He's the director, so it's probably right. I mean, the you know, Blas will not get his reimbursement unless this is right. So here I took the opportunity to, again, go through a few different values of background. So you see, it really matters. If you could do a background-free experiment, the answer's better. I mean, that's... but it deteriorates pretty quickly.
Can we get that quote framed? Okay.
So... I have to not tell any good jokes while they change the tapes.
This background is just flat.
Yeah, it's just flat in energy. And I could put in something else. I was just lazy last night. Now, okay, so I won't show you the rest of the bets, but I do want to talk about summer versus winter. This is actually a very important thing for the inelastic models, which are so highly modulated, as Neil and others have said. So if we just... So now we have pictures of some arbitrary university. Take events at 40, 50, 65, just to see what happens, because these are kind of up in the high range that you really would not expect these to be the three events if it were elastic. So I'm kind of pushing things to the wall here to see what happens. So you can see in this case, half count background, delta really wants to be over here, far from zero. Okay, this is very significant. This is if the events happen in the summer when the modulation is supposed to be, you know, helping us. Now, if we go to the fall, Harvard Yard still looks pretty, but now we have the contours kind of smearing out a bit because the fit's more likely to say it's background if it's not at the expected time of year. And if we go to the winter, things are really pretty grim, and you should really spend a few weeks in Santa Barbara. See, I was going to put seasons for Santa Barbara, but all the pictures looked exactly the same. I had to go to Harvard to find some, you know. But look how much worse the contours look, right? The delta equals zero is not even ruled out at 2 sigma in the marginalized likelihood, because the fit's saying these events are in the winter. They're crap.
I should point out, it's easy to find winter pictures of Sudan.
Yeah, okay. Yes, 9 out of every 8 pictures of Sudan. So let me just blink between these again, because I think it's so terribly interesting that depending on the time of year the events occur, with only three events, you could have very good evidence for inelastic dark matter, or you could have no evidence at all for inelastic dark matter. And so that's why we're dying to know when the events are. This is, of course, I didn't put anything in here about the CDMS live times and when, you know, this is just if you had uniform exposure throughout the year. But all that will be easy to do if you get events like this. We will certainly do this by this evening. So then I was just also playing here with what happens if the background is lower. Of course, you get even tighter contours. You can imagine how it goes. So I won't bother you with the rest of the plots because Neil made me start my talk before they were finished running. So that's it for now. Any questions before I unplug?
Aaron, do you want to look at any of these particular plots more carefully?
No, I appreciate all the effort. Yeah. I really, it's quite flattering, actually, to see speculation about your own experiment in such wonderful detail. Thank you.
To see that that people would really desperately try to draw some conclusion for three events.
I'm impressed. Okay. I had one, tart comment, which is, this doesn't apply only to CDMS, but everybody, that an odd thing is sometimes limits, not signals, but limits can be better when background is higher. I don't know if you pondered the statement for a second. This is a puzzle that we've known about. The last 20 years has been an era of limits in particle physics, where we make limits all the time. And it's one of those odd little things that, if you have a certain number of events and your background is higher, the room for the signal is lower, okay? It's a very simple concept, and, this has been scrutinized with Feldman cousins and all sorts of things, but it's annoying, isn't it? You want an experiment with the lowest background you can to make a discovery.
Sure.
But, when one defines blind analysis, sometimes one says, okay, most likely thing is a limit, and maybe cuts get dialed in blind for the best limit, maybe, okay. Well, I showed a plot actually in my talk on Monday, but you got to remember it was done blind. So there's a nice phrase that Ed Thorndike at Clio used to say: "We may be stupid, but we're fair."
Well, on that note, we should go on to the next slide. Do you need a different? Okay. Oh, wait. That's working in the nick of time. You talk in your mic.
This will be super short. This is my prediction for what's going to appear on the archive until tomorrow. But more seriously, this is a plot from Ellis and company that shows some scatter plot of CMSSM parameter space. And if CDMS sees anything, that means that they must have been unlucky in the last experiment. This is the bound from the last experiment. And they must have been really unlucky last time, and we're just right sitting on that cross-section. But then you can ask what part of the CMSSM gives you that cross-section not already excluded by other things. And it's really just this point. Well, this part of the scatter plate. So the green things are things which are viable, but they're excluded by having a Higgs which is too light. Hasn't been seen. This part of parameter space is the prediction for spin-dependent stuff. And so the only thing which you could see, this thing is viable, but you won't see it, it's too low. So the only thing viable is right here. And this is assuming the right relic. So all those points have, that's right, in the thermal world. So in particular, this is in the funnel region where you have a Higgs. The one interesting thing to note about this graph is that I think, I'm pretty certain that this region corresponds to this region, and this is a prediction for spin-dependent part, I think. And so the problem is that the sensitivity currently is at roughly 0.2 picobarn. So we're a little far away from that. But in principle, if you see something like that, you could say this is a prediction and go look for that. Okay, so this is for tomorrow, archive.
Xenon 100 would see that.
Yeah.
That's right.
It would get into the red.
I believe so, yeah. Yeah. So there is this correlation here. This is more vanilla models that was already discussed in 2000 by Maxim Pospolo, who is here. And in this model, you just couple a single scalar to the Higgs. So you have a scalar Higgs, and you interact with your nuclei through a Higgs exchange. And what those fellows have done is that they've calculated for a given Higgs mass, all those points give you the right radic abundance, and this is what you would predict from direct detection. So I've not done any work here. All of the work is in this paper. The only thing I've done is superimpose CDMS current best limit, which was not available in 2000. And you see that, again, if they see anything tomorrow or today, sorry, they must have been unlucky last time, and we must see it somewhere on this curve. And so you can ask, where in that model can you possibly be? And you see that really you could have only been below here, right? All the other points are, you just won't get enough cross-section to see it today. So that's pretty much all I have to say.
Just to make the obvious point, in most cases, this is assuming
the Malone
weapon, so that's actually
interesting.
It's
there is a viable part.
If you're otherwise convinced that this is the right picture, then it will prove that cosmology diluted the stuff so much that the thermal history must be non-centric, which is interesting. Which is an interesting thing to learn.
Oh, it goes the other way, right?
No, it goes exactly the way I'm saying. I mean, if the company was big enough that you did see something at CDMS, you would so annihilate the stuff earlier on that it has to be repopulated in another standard day later. That's a fascinating thing to look at.
My only comment is that we have a third author in the big Brentonis that are wrong with us. And the very similar model was discussed even earlier by John McDonald.
Okay.
Are you on the screen? Yeah, no, I'm on the screen. I'm on the board here.
All right, so MEMA is, now that we've seen all the possibilities, MEMA is going to tell us, when we actually think about particle physics, how we might interpret that. Wait, who has the mic? Do you have the mic?
Oh, sorry. In the spirit of extremely simple things that are all out there in the literature in one way or another, but just to try to gather everything in one spot. Maybe organize things a little bit differently. Also, I have some nice panels here. So I want to organize the discussion by thinking about what the interactions are that we could be probing at CDMS at a variety of levels. First, in the simplest possible level, at the level of the non-relativistic quantum mechanics problem for the scattering of the dark matter particle against the entire nucleus. For the purpose of this discussion, I'm going to assume that we're talking about coherent things. We can change things when it's not coherent, but let's assume we're talking about coherent things. So I'm going to be talking about interactions between dark matter and the nucleus. And here we'll just list a number of possible interactions that you might just have in the non-relativistic Schrodinger problem. Then what we'll do is, so just at the level of the non-relativistic theory, then we'll talk about what effective operators upstairs for Fermi operators, other kinds of operators, could generate that, those couplings. Then we'll talk about how we could generate these effective operators, so completing these effective operators in this panel. And here we'll have two possibilities. We can complete them with particles that are in the standard model, or we can complete with particles not in the standard model. And let's see, did I have another category? Well, I guess there's a question. I don't know the answer for this, for all the cases, but is obviously one of the very, very interesting questions to talk about, which we can talk about, because if they're seeing something, the cross-section is relatively big. In any model, you can, of course, the actual relic abundance calculation is complicated, and there's more interactions going on than are necessarily the ones that would be being probed at CDMS. But you could minimally take the interactions you need to get the cross-section. And since the couplings can't be terribly small, you can ask just with those interactions alone, what would you predict for the relic density? And if with those interactions alone, the relic density is small, then this is just the logic we were talking about a second ago. That's very interesting, because in this picture, you would have direct evidence for a non-standard cosmology, which is perfectly reasonable to have a non-standard cosmology, but it'd be fascinating to be able to make such an inference from this experiment. Okay, so let's start here and write down in the non-relativistic limit. Now, there's of course an infinite number of things that you can do, but I'm going to take the two natural extremes. One of them, that in the non-relativistic limit, the interaction that we're talking about is point-like. It looks like a contact interaction. By point-like, we mean point-like on scales compared to 1 over 100 MeV, which is the momentum transfer involved. So point-like doesn't have to mean the weak scale. It just means relative to the momentum transfers involved. So this is the first thing you can have. Delta cubed of R, some scale, 1 over lambda squared. That's the first thing that you can have. Okay, and the cross-section in this case would go like the reduced mass of the nucleon dark matter system, so let me call that mu dark matter, over lambda squared squared. Just to remind you, the going rate just from particles with order 1 couplings and weak scale, cross sections, everything normal, weak scale to Z, the going rate is, when you normalize per nucleon, is 10 to the minus 38 centimeters squared per nucleon. So we'll keep that number in mind. And the cross sections we're talking about are like 10 to the minus 44. So something is suppressing these things by about a factor of a million. Okay, very good. Okay, so this is the first kind of interaction we can have. There is a very important other parameter that we have to specify here, and I'll just do the story for them one at a time, which is the number of dark matter states that are involved. Is there exactly one real state, which is the stable particle and so on, or are there more than one of them with the very nearby masses? And I remind you, the second picture is even completely relevant for elastic scattering if you're talking about some kind of a Dirac particle or any situation where the dark matter is charged under some global symmetry that puts a number of states degenerate with each other, which is a very reasonable thing given that some symmetry is needed to keep the dark matter stable to begin with. So the first round here is with one state. So let's do one state, and then we'll do more than one state. This is not going to take long. So, okay. So one state.
Told the public lecture last night after 2.5.
No, that's all right. Okay. No, just a single particle, one particle, and any other states that might be nearby are split by more than 100, by more than 100 kV. So they're just not relevant. Okay. So this is the first interesting case to talk about. Maybe I should write smaller here. Sorry. So we can have the cross section here goes like, as we said, mu dark matter over lambda squared squared. So let's first talk about this one. So what could the effective operator be? Well, this could be, now it depends. Here we didn't say anything about the spin of the particle. The particle could be a scalar, and it could be something, there's just one real state, so there it is. It could be phi phi q bar q. Okay, that could be that kind of coupling. Again, if this is coming from the weak scale, the coefficient of this coupling has got to be around 10 to the minus 3 in order for the, if this is now as a particle physics operator suppressed by the weak scale, the coefficient has got to be around 10 to the minus 3 in order to in order to get us the right abundance.
We also, wait, did I mention something?
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm W, just in this case, sorry.
Put in a vector Planck mass in there or something.
Yeah, of course. But we could normalize that, but I'm not putting in the quark mass there. Of course, that's
naturally 10 to the minus 3.
It is naturally 10 to the minus 3 if you put in the strain. So we could do that as well. But let me just leave it like this. So of course you're right. It could be a Majorana coupling of exactly the same form. And the coefficient would have to be 10 to the minus 3. The one thing it cannot be is a coupling like this. Or it cannot be that, because this thing vanishes for a single real Majorana fermion. Okay.
Considering spin one?
Sorry?
Are you considering spin one?
For this discussion, I'm not. We could consider spin one too, but I'm just going to stick with spin zero and spin a half. All right. So the completions with the standard model are the obvious ones. We can integrate out of Higgs. Everyone has talked about this already. We can integrate out of Higgs to generate these couplings, and then you get the right size Yukawa coupling. Here, I should mention this thing many of us have talked about, that to get something big enough, we need the fact that the way this couples through the nucleon is through the matrix element of M strange S bar S. This is the thing that dominates. This matrix element is normally taken to be around 300 MeV in the nucleus. But there are some recent suggestions that it might be smaller. This might matter. Anyway, this is the thing. The 300 MeV over the weak scale gives us the 10 to the minus 3 factor, and it's about right.
There is a Hayden-Quark contribution as well.
Right. So
small.
Yeah. No, I agree. So I think this is it's basically okay. That's perfectly reasonable. Just the obvious comment, this really prefers a light Higgs. This would not happen with a 300 GV Higgs. The rate is going like 1 over m Higgs to the fourth. So this is perfectly, totally reasonable. This is, I think, the nicest thing about this entire story, is that this cross-section is completely reasonably associated with Higgs exchange. And it also tells you any theory, MSSM, just any theory that mixes, that has some reasonable order one coupling of a Majorana fermion to the Higgs is guaranteed to give you the right answer. So of course we all know this. Okay, so from that we're not learning very much. Also, some other totally obvious comments. We can complete this in beyond the standard model also in 100 ways. Let's not list them all. A particularly simple one is to imagine that you have two Higgs doublets and you're at large tangent beta. And then you can even live off the heavier Higgs if its mass isn't heavier enough that it beats it. And finally, we had this discussion about the relic here already, but in the case where it's a scalar, there's really nothing you can do. You just do the calculation. It's what Itai showed us, and it's interesting. If we get an indication, well, The only way it worked with the relic abundance, as we saw, had the dark matter down at 40 or 50 GeV, and it's from Spencer's analysis that really seems ruled out. So
depends on what we see here.
It depends on what we see. Of course, it depends on. It's conceivable that it'll be ruled out anyway. So that in that picture, you might be forced to heavier masses, which doesn't mean that it's wrong. It does mean that the cosmological history has to be non-thermal. It's not a thermal relic. It has to be repopulated later. Okay, so let's keep going with one state and now try the next interesting coupling. The next interesting coupling that we could just write down also is also still a contact interaction, but now could involve something that looks like the spin of the dark matter particle dot the velocity of the nucleus. So if the dark matter has a spin, this is what we can do. Now, of course, you look at this and you think it's going to be suppressed relative to this one because there's a factor of the velocity in it. But on the other hand, it's easier to get from an ultraviolet completion. So this can come about from a chi bar gamma mu gamma 5 chi times a core current as an effective operator. So now the particle has to have a spin, obviously. We don't want to have the other coupling with the V dot spin of the nucleus, because in this whole discussion, I'm assuming that things are coherent.
Okay. The scalar kind of scalar would do the same thing.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, sorry, pseudoscalar.
So the scalar on the dark matter and...
You mean move the gamma 5s around?
No. Oh. This is a different operators. If psi bar, gamma 5 psi...
Oh, you want to just put a gamma 5 here.
But I'm saying that there is another operator that
yes.
does exactly the same thing, and they are not reducible one to another. And
okay.
They have different parity properties.
Okay.
Wait, isn't the gamma 5 operator only act on the spin of the dark matter?
I mean, you only want to pick up the spin of the dark matter. That's all I'm saying.
We can have psi bar gamma 5 psi times q bar q, and it's the same.
Oh, sure. Okay.
And
the non-relativistic regime is the same. Okay. Very good.
I still think the actors not spin dark matter into the nucleus.
You pick up the zero component there, right? And it's a helicity.
Yeah, I think he's right.
Bar Q is that kind of particle. That's
bar Q does not depend on the nucleus, right? It's just an acid. So it has to be spin dark matter dotted into the velocity of the dark matter instead of.
We're looking for
relative velocity.
Yeah.
There is only the relative velocity
yeah.
and the problem.
Yeah. That's right. Anyway. All I want to say is that you could get this from, so this is the operator you need. You could get this from some effective Z exchange again. Now the what we need is something that's not very suppressed, because the 10 to the minus 3 for the velocity is about the same as the 10 to the minus 3 we were paying before for the Yukawa couple. Okay? But this is easily possible. The cross section in this case, so in other words, if you're happy that the Yukawa coupling to the strange is making the 10 to the minus 44 cross section plausible, you should also be happy roughly that this velocity dependent coupling would also make a 10 to the minus 44 cross section plausible. The same factor of 10 to the minus 3, one from the strange Yukawa coupling, the other from the velocity of the dark matter. But they differ in the energy distribution, and here the cross section scales like velocity squared, so it scales like the energy. Okay, I won't write it down, but it scales like the energy. Here it's a constant, and here it scales like v squared. Right.
It scales like velocity, but that's not the same thing as scaling like energy, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. It goes like the.
It's still the distribution.
It goes like velocity squared.
Still flat.
Yeah.
But
no, right. No, that's right. But the
you'll get higher velocity.
Exactly. What I mean is that you
power of energy in the differential cross section.
That's all I'm saying. The differential cross section has an extra power of energy.
But when you integrate, right? And if I just take the velocity, right, I can still have a low energy. The cross section now depends on the velocity.
I'm talking about the differential cross section here. I'm just saying the differential cross section has an extra factor of energy in it, and it pushes you to higher energies.
No, but you have to integrate up with the velocity, right?
Of course. So you have to convolute it with the.
Oh. Which is an exponential, so.
The, yes, of the, course. No.
The
so,
high energy tail of it. Right?
Because it starts getting colored. No, Richard, I don't know. So I'm just talking about what the microscopic. I'm just talking about what the microscopic cross section looks like. There's an extra factor of energy. Of course, you have to convolute with all of those things. So. Okay. So there's a few other things that, so now, and that's all you can do if you want to have contact interactions. You can also have things that are not contact interactions. So, well, the simplest thing that you could have is something that looked like and some kind of alpha effective over R. Okay? So V could be some alpha effective over R. That's perfectly fine. You just have to dial down alpha effective appropriately in order to get this. Here, again, the coupling can't go through chi bar gamma mu chi. It's got to just be a chi bar chi q bar q type coupling. That means that we're not going to get this at any interesting level in the, obviously not going to get this at any interesting level in the standard model. The only massless particle we could be talking about is the photon, and by assumption, the dark matter isn't charged. Okay? So you're not going to get this in the standard model. So you won't get that, you won't generate this in the standard model, but of course there's 100 ways of generating it beyond the standard model, and we could imagine having light mediators, whatever you want, which are light compared to the scale, energy scale that we're talking about. And these things are going to give you a cross section now that go. Oh, so sorry, but I should say again, if we're going to have light mediators, there should be scalars here. If it's got to be scalar mediators if we just have a single state. So again, can't be a vector. But the important point here is that the cross section now is going to scale like 1 over q squared squared. So if that had an energy in it, this is going to have a 1 over energy squared, relatively speaking. So we have constant from the contact interaction, something that microscopically goes like E, and now from some kind of light exchange on the scale of interest, a cross-section that goes like 1 over E squared. I really shouldn't have jumped to this one first, just in doing things in order. There's one in between these two, which is if there's an effective potential that looks like something that looks like a dipole moment over R squared. So spin of the dark matter dot R hat. Okay. So you can have a dipole coupling to the nucleus, and here there's no scale in the problem. Both the kinetic and potential terms go like 1 over R squared. So the cross section is just set by the momentum transfer and a single parameter in the problem, which is the dipole moment times it's coherent, so there would be an A here, times the reduced mass of the dark matter system. So this is the dimensionless coupling, that thing squared times now just 1 over Q squared is what the cross section would look like. So this is something that goes like 1 over energy. So this scales like 1 over energy. And again, you can't get this in the standard model. You might have an electric dipole moment of the dark matter particle, but you can't write that down with a single species again, because chi bar, gamma mu, gamma nu, sigma mu nu, chi, f mu nu, again, vanishes for, this vanishes identically for a single particle. But once again, we could do it beyond the standard model if we coupled it appropriately to some kind of scalar. So already, just with a single state, we can get the right size cross section without any kind of accident. We can get it from without any sort of accident at all. We can get it from a Higgs exchange and also from a velocity dependent piece. And already we see sigmas that scale like E or 1 or 1 over E or 1 over E squared. And this is probing what the effective quantum mechanics problem is involved in the scattering. Okay. So let's just finish the story and talk about what happens when we have two states. So if we have two states, exactly the same analysis holds, except now the operators on the quantum mechanics side are always the same. Now we can generate some of them using just standard model particles. So for example, the very first one, our friend the contact interaction, if there's two states, now there is another way of generating it in the standard model, not through Higgs exchange, but through some effective coupling to the Z. Okay, so we could just do that with an effective coupling through the Z, a chi 1 and a chi 2, and we'd have an effectively, if we put these two guys into a Dirac multiplet, well, let me write it more vilely just to make it completely clear. We could have some effective coupling of this guy to the Z, and once again, we have to dial this coupling down by around 10 to the minus 3. Okay. So whatever it is not something that's directly coupled to the Z. That means that actually, this is not an operator in the theory above the scale where electroweak symmetry is broken. So if we really want to talk about where it's coming from, we have to, in one way or another, generate the operator chi bar chi Higgs dagger d mu Higgs divided by some scale squared, some higher scale squared, m higher. We want this coupling to be small, so this is going to be coming from a higher scale. And now there's a variety of options. This could come, for example, at tree level, if you just integrate out something that directly mixes, you mix a singlet with a doublet. Okay, you mix a singlet with a doublet, you integrate out the guys that you're mixing with, and you can easily generate a coupling like this, suppressed by v squared over m squared. If m is 5 to ev, that gives you 10 to ev, that gives you your 10 to the minus 3. Okay, so it doesn't have to be very far from the weak scale to get the 10 to the minus 3 suppression. It's a Dirac fermion mixing, right, that's right. Of course, you could also generate this at one loop right at the weak scale. It's like an S-parameter type operator. You could generate it one loop right at the weak scale, and then its coefficient is an alpha, and it's around the right value again. Okay? So either something at tree level at 10 TeV, one loop at 1 TeV could induce the coupling you need to get you the 10 to the minus 3 factor that gets you the right cross-section. So this is also something I think totally reasonable. Right, of course. That's right. So that's just what we're saying, right? What we're saying, if this thing is effectively up at 5 TeV, or however else you want to say it, but effectively we're getting this operator with some coupling. All I wanted to say is when we say we're coupling to the Z, since it can't really be coupling to the Z directly, we really mean this coupling. Okay? That's all I wanted to say. Okay? So that's another reasonable possibility. So let's quickly go through some of the other ones. We could have be a dipole moment dot R the dipole moment coupling. We could still have the spin dot V coupling, but that's not very different between one state and two states. So let's talk about the one thing which is more interesting when you have two states, which is that you really get to have the dipole moment dot electric field coupling. So really coupled to the charge of the nucleus over R squared. We have this effective interaction. And now the dipole moment, so that effective dimensionless strength of the interaction is d mu q. The dipole moment is naturally alpha times some, this would have to be an electric dipole moment for it to have any hope in hell, of course, because the nucleus has a macroscopic electric charge and not a macroscopic magnetic charge. So this would have to be a CP violating effect, but the size of this dimensionless coupling is alpha times theta CP, some CP violating phase. And on the other hand, this is dominated at low energies. The cross section is going like 1 over Q squared. It doesn't have any G Fermis in it. Okay? And so you can put in the numbers and a reasonable theta CP of order 10 to the minus 2 of the sort that you're familiar with to suppress EDMs in any garden variety of extension. The standard model gives you a 10 to the minus 44 cross section. So that's another interesting coincidence, that a perfectly reasonable CP violating phase that would give you a perfectly reasonable value for the electron EDM coupled up all the same way together would also give you a reasonable 10 to the minus 44 cross section. Just one cautionary note, if you want to do this, you want to make sure that whatever you're integrating out does not generate this operator at an equal or bigger level, okay? Or at a bigger level. So, but it's extremely easy to, we can talk about more detailed microscopic theories, but what I really wanted to stress was that this option is also, I think, alive and well, and it has an energy distribution, again, so the sigma here goes like 1 over E. rather than a constant. So, and I think that is, I believe that's, that is everything for the review. What I really wanted to stress, again, many of you know this just as well as I do, if not better, but what I wanted to stress is that at the level of the quantum mechanics, at the level of the actual scattering, there isn't much going on. So what our friends are doing is really probing that, okay? And then we can have hundreds of theories for generating all of these couplings, and we just went through an exercise of how easy it is to get them to buy us this little 10 to the minus 3 factor to explain the 10 to the minus 44 cross-section. I think what I'm most excited about at zeroth order is that Higgs exchange just works. That's the simplest, stupidest possible thing. Just seems to work. It's perfectly fine. That means any theory of weak scale physics, any theory at all, that mixes a little bit, that has a reasonable coupling to the Higgs, will do it. It also tells you there's a gigantic degeneracy, what's really being probed by this experiment is just what, I mean, if this is what it looks like, would just be the coupling to the Higgs and nothing else. And so I think, what? Sorry? No, but I'm just saying that there's a, I'm just talking about for the overall rate. And to the extent possible, and I don't know the extent to which this has been studied, certainly the cases that have a rise in energy for the reasons that Spencer and Neil were referring to, where the microscopic cross-section rises with energy, might be very, very hard to tell apart because it gets cut off so rapidly anyway at higher energies that you might not be able to tell. But it could be interesting, asymptotically, perhaps with hundreds of events, to see just as a foil for the case with a constant cross-section where there's no energy dependence, to see whether one would be able to distinguish the 1 over energy and 1 over energy squared dependences. Because I think, you know, really most responsibly, we'll first, from the direct detection experiments, be able to figure out what we're seeing at this level. And then we know very well mapping into this direction is a child's play for all of us. So that's it.
Questions for Nima? I'm sure we'll have more questions for Nima later. So can I just say, remind anybody, in case we're not aware, there's an announcement today. Again, we're going to do our best to have a live feed here in this room. This is the intention to have it here.
When do we need to be here to get a good seat?
I would just stay where you are. So come early and get a seat. Yep, see you all there. Thank you.